Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project. Everybody's wasting time. Everybody stands in line.
Schools around the country facing huge challenges when it comes to remote learning, saying that online tools are not as effective as in-person classes, especially when trying to keep students motivated. Doug McElway is live outside an elementary school in Arlington, Virginia this morning with more. Doug, we all want to know more about this. Good morning.
Sure do. A lot of parents sitting on pins and needles. Tuckahoe Elementary School here is part of the Arlington County School District, which has already made the decision to continue distance learning come the fall semester. Now, that may be subject to change, may be subject to variation depending on conditions, but it has angered a lot of parents, as distance learning has in many places. Take, for example, senior Max Wolfschlegel. He is so done with high school, McLean High School in Fairfax County, Virginia, nearby. He's off to work at Chick-fil-A in the Ford Crown Victoria that with 140,000 miles on the odometer that he bought with his own money. He's banking his cash, and he's bid good riddance to school and to distance learning that by almost all accounts was a failure in Fairfax County, Virginia.
First month or so was a complete mess, and now it's kind of mellowed out and it's more uniform. Me personally, I chose to kind of stay away from the whole distance learning thing. I know personally that I am not a very good learner when it comes to learning through a computer screen.
Distance learning has not worked well elsewhere. Some school districts in Georgia, Nebraska, Texas, D.C., and elsewhere have ended the school year early as a result of that.
So in some ways, it's no surprise that families are at home wondering where the $15,000 in spending is going per student in this country.
Nobody is going to be getting it right from the start, but something is better than nothing. And so if we can keep kids learning during this difficult time and keep them connected with their teacher and their friends at school somehow, that's a great thing right now.
In the worst cases, distance learning has suffered from poor planning, badly designed programs, the lack of face-to-face contact with teachers, and socioeconomic hardship, some students lacking high-speed internet and parental support. The American Federation of Children has commissioned a poll which found that as many as 40% of American parents are now considering homeschooling or some sort of virtual learning because of their frustration. And adding to the uncertainty, the nation's two biggest teachers unions have said that they will go on strike if proper precautions are not in place come the fall semester. By proper precautions, they're talking about temperature checks, proper clothing, and also contact tracing. So we'll see. It's so much uncertainty right now, Sandra.
Thank you very much for that report. We'll be following it all the way into the fall. Thanks.
First of all, could you imagine deliberating over a $15,000 purchase? Where the most compelling selling point was something is better than nothing? And here's a very similar report from one of our so-called peer countries.
10 days and counting to the moment England schools welcome back some of the country's youngest learners.
We've had to think really very carefully about how we enable access to the building. To different parts.
A school tour like no other, yet the head teacher has no idea how many will come through his door.
We've approached it that parents can make their own mind up till the last minute. 5 o'clock on Friday evening, they might have a change of heart. And we accept that, and we understand that, and I totally accept the reasons why that is the case.
For all the ways teachers have tried to make their classrooms safe, our poll suggests, and suggests strongly, that most parents are not convinced. The survey of 1,000 parents shows 60% believe it's unsafe to send their children back. Only a third think it's safe. Here's why. 82% are concerned for their child's health, and more than half worry about a rise in the number of COVID cases. Life in lockdown isn't all fresh air and fun.
There are a lot of fights in my house.
Nor is homeschooling as good as the real thing. We brought together seven parents all keen to get back to the old routine. 23 children between them. One crucial question to answer. Which of you will definitely send your children back to school in June? Three will, four won't. A big dilemma.
She's nudging me now saying, send me. And that is, you know, a huge emotional weight that I carry. But her health is paramount.
I feel a lot of children will have loved ones at home who might potentially be quite vulnerable. So I think it's putting a lot of pressure on 11-year-olds.
That's reflected in our poll. When asked directly, will you send your children back? 59% say no, just 35% say yes.
Too soon for me.
The two teachers on our panel will send their children back.
I'm not that worried, and maybe that's wrong, I don't know, but I just think we have to take a step forward. That's how I feel. And I just think when I weigh it up, that's the choice I'm going to make.
There's lots of big questions, but we need to try and get back to a sense of normality. And with the older children, I think they are able to follow the protocols. It's going to be like a military operation. It has to be. You're lucky I care for fools like you.
You're lucky I'm there to stop people doing the things that you know they are dying to do. You're lucky I care for fools like you. You're lucky I'm there stop people doing the things that you know they are dying to do. Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. We begin here the final week of June, a week that was for 12 years of my life, the greatest of the year. School is out. But as you heard in those two reports, many families in the United States and elsewhere, Canada, Australia, like all over those countries, I could have done an hour-long compilation of news reports similar to that. Many families are contemplating whether or not school is out for good, which means we are likely entering a golden age of opportunity for alternative education. Private schooling, homeschooling, microschooling, unschooling. But as we talked about on the show back in April, there's a concerted effort of people in academia and media to challenge this long overdue revolution. In academia, it is about pointing out the supposed dangers of home education, while in media, it is more about creating a misleading link between the forced quarantine schooling everyone had to endure over the last few months and true home or real world learner-driven education. Or, you know, that unschooling approach is certainly not going to be for everybody. Some parents just want to free their children from the increasingly toxic, dangerous, and surveillance state. Oh, God, wait till the fall. Surveillance state environment the public schools are. So back in April, Corey DeAngelis and I talked in detail about a paper that appeared in the Arizona Law Review written by Harvard Law professor Elizabeth Bartholet. It created quite a stir. This stir was a very positive development. There's a very energetic response in many ways led by Corey DeAngelis and today's guest, Carrie McDonald, who raised awareness about the attack on homeschooling and school choice and mounted a very effective defense, culminating with an event at the beginning of last week hosted by the Cato Institute. It was called Homeschooling, Protecting Freedom, Protecting Children. It featured that Harvard professor, Elizabeth Bartholet, along with Milton Gator, professor of education at Messiah College, the author of Homeschooling in American History, Neil McCluskey, the director of the Center for Educational Freedom at Cato, and Carrie McDonald. I watched the debate live and didn't take many notes and was frustrated in many parts. And then I watched the replay and prepared some questions, and I invited Carrie back on the show to do a kind of debriefing about the experience. So that's what you're going to hear today. Many of you, I'm guessing, already attended this event. I know thousands of people did. I think almost 20,000 have watched the YouTube video, and I assume those viewers overlap with our audience considerably. But for those of you who did not see it or are completely unfamiliar, here's a description of the event from Cato,
Long before COVID-19 forced almost all children to receive education at home, homeschooling, a parental decision to educate their children at home, was growing. For advocates, its purpose and value is to open space for diversity, enabling families to provide education different from what any school offers. Critics fear it isolates children from the myriad people and ideas in society, you know, about how society has myriad people and ideas, and can enable child abuse to go unchecked. These positions have recently come into high-profile conflict and seem irreconcilable. Are they? Or do both sides have legitimate concerns that can be resolved through compromise? Join us for this timely discussion. And for those of you who have not heard this, I wanted to insert here at the beginning of the show the opening statements from Kerry, who's an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute and the author of Unschooled, Raising Curious, Well-Educated Children Outside the Conventional Classroom, and Elizabeth Bartholet, who wrote this very controversial and thoroughly criticized Arizona Law Review paper called Homeschooling Parent Rights Absolutism versus Child Rights to Education and Protection. Obviously, the paper has no shortage of valid concerns, I would say, about child welfare, a topic that we have covered from a variety of different angles on this show for years. And of course, I've relayed to you a lot of my own experience working with kids who came from abusive home situations. Unfortunately, despite the thorough criticism of the paper, many left-wing anti-homeschooling media outlets were happy to have a lot of shallow and uninformed criticisms of home education regurgitated into their mouths by trusty experts so they could quickly spit it back up on an uncritical public. I'm sorry about the imagery there. That's kind of how all this works, though. If you're brand new to this topic, I highly recommend you go back to our archives in April and listen to the two shows that I did on this topic with Corey DeAngelis. But we'll start today with those opening statements. And if you did already hear this, I sped them up a little bit and tried to get them as close to 15 minutes as possible. So if you already heard this and you want to get on to my discussion with Kerry, jump 15 minutes ahead on your counter and you will be just about right there. All right, everybody, that's it. Thanks for listening. Huge thanks to Kerry McDonald for coming back and sharing her thoughts about this much-anticipated event. I'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Neil, and thank you to the Cato Institute for hosting this important event. I'm honored to be on today's panel and look forward to a dynamic discussion. Since Professor Elizabeth Bartholet's Arizona Law Review article this spring prompted a corresponding feature in the May-June issue of Harvard Magazine emphasizing the risks of homeschooling, parents who have chosen this education option, as well as others who champion education choice, are understandably upset and angry. I am a homeschooling parent right here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, just a couple of blocks away from Harvard's main campus, who has spent much of my life and career advocating to protect the right of families to live free from government intervention. And I am both surprised and concerned at the deeply illiberal values that undergird arguments to limit homeschooling freedoms. Professor Bartholet proposes a presumptive ban on homeschooling that would allow homeschooling only after parents first prove that they are worthy of the task, and after they also agree to other government involvement, such as regular home visits by government-mandated reporters of child abuse, frequent standardized testing, and requiring that their children still take at least some classes at their local government school. Certainly sounds like a homeschooling ban to me. At the heart of this challenge is a fundamental question. Should government intervene in family life and monitor the myriad choices each family makes when there is no evidence of wrongdoing? In other words, is the role of government to suggest that families are guilty until proven innocent and must be kept under close watch in order to protect children? We should all be concerned about protecting children. The question is, who is presumed to be better suited to this task, parents or the state? Professor Bartholet is concerned about protecting children in three ways: ideologically, academically, and physically. Beginning with the ideological, and while relying on astonishingly false stereotypes of today's homeschoolers, she writes in her Law Review piece, quote, "A very large proportion of homeschooling parents are ideologically committed to isolating their children from the majority culture and indoctrinating them in views and values that are in serious conflict with that culture." She goes on to write, "The nature of the homeschooling population presents dangers for children and society," end quote. This rhetoric is nothing new, a deep distrust of parents, and in particular, parents who may be skeptical of prevailing cultural ideology, is a stain on the history of American education that continues today. The 19th century roots of U.S. compulsory schooling reveal disdain toward many families, especially Irish Catholic immigrant parents, who challenged the dominant Anglo-Saxon Protestant culture of the time. Calling for a compulsory schooling law, William Swan, editor of the Massachusetts Teacher, wrote in 1851, quote, "Our chief difficulty is with the Irish." He goes on to say, "In too many instances, the parents are unfit guardians of their own children. Nothing can operate effectually here but stringent legislation thoroughly carried out by an efficient police. The children must be gathered up and forced into school, and those who resist or impede this plan, whether parents or priests, must be held accountable and punished," end quote. 1 year later, Massachusetts passed the nation's first compulsory school attendance law, which for the first time mandated that parents send their children to school under a legal threat of force. Many Catholic parents rebelled and established their own parallel system of parochial schools, which the government continuously tried to attack and weaken. This effort peaked in 1922 when Oregon banned private schools, a law that was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, stating that the child is not the mere creature of the state. Today, homeschooling parents fight a similar ongoing battle to raise and educate their children as they choose, free from government intervention. Critics of homeschooling, as well as those who seek heightened regulation, argue that the government should ensure a particular educational standard through ongoing oversight and evaluation. It may seem convenient to impose government control on families who opt out of conventional schooling, but it limits freedom, originality, experimentation, and divergence. We may not like how different families choose to live and learn, but that is no excuse to intolerantly impose our own preferences on them through government force. And let's be very clear, this is government force that is being called for here. In addition to being concerned with ideological indoctrination of homeschooled children by their parents, while seemingly ignoring the widespread indoctrination of children in government schools, Professor Barthelet is also concerned about homeschooling parents' abilities to effectively guide their children's education academically. While more inquiry is welcomed, most of the research on homeschooling families conducted over the past several decades, including a recent literature review by Dr. Lindsay Burke of the Heritage Foundation, finds positive academic outcomes of homeschooling children. Additionally, 2019 research by Professor Daniel Hamlin at the University of Oklahoma found that compared to children in government schools, homeschooled children are 2 to 3 times more likely to go to a library, museum, art gallery, historic site, or cultural event, and 1.5 times more likely to visit a zoo, aquarium, or bookstore during the course of a month. If we contrast these findings with the academic results of children in government schools, we should really be asking ourselves, why are we even having this debate? According to the most recent NAEP scores, math and reading scores declined, and 2/3 of U.S. students are not reading proficiently. Additionally, only 15% of students are proficient in U.S. history. If the government can't even ensure an adequate academic environment for the children enrolled in its own schools, how can it possibly argue for the right to control those who opt out? In her law review article, Professor Barthelet also explains that she advocates for a presumptive ban on homeschooling to protect children from physical abuse or neglect that could be hidden if children don't attend school. As with the academic argument, there is no compelling evidence that homeschooling parents are more likely to abuse their children than non-homeschooling parents. And some research to suggest that homeschooling parents are actually less likely to abuse their children. Additionally, and perhaps most disturbingly, this argument ignores the fact that children are routinely abused in government schools by government educators. Headlines abound of educators abusing children on school premises. And a 2004 U.S. Department of Education study found that 1 in 10 children who attend a government school will be sexually maltreated by a government school employee by the time the child graduates from high school. That is 5 million kids. And that is only abuse of children by educators. Peer abuse in the form of peer sexual assault and bullying is rampant in schools, with data suggesting that nearly half of all school children in grades 4 to 12 are bullied at least once a month. Professor Barthelet concludes her law review article by saying that, quote, "To the degree public schools are seriously deficient, our society should work on improving them, rather than simply allowing some parents to escape," end quote. The government should work to improve its own schools where academic deficiencies and abuse are pervasive, but it should have no role in deciding whether or not parents are allowed to escape. Instead of presumptive bans, we should be celebrating the freedom and flexibility of homeschooling and using it as a model for government schools to follow. Thank you.
Elizabeth? Thank you, Neil and Cato. I approach the homeschooling issues from the perspective that children should be seen as having rights and rights that are of equal value to adult rights. And in connection with that, I think, and related some to how some of the things Neil said, children don't have the power that adults do to protect themselves. So I think it's important that the government be there as a protector for children and be able to intervene to help protect some of their most fundamental rights. So in terms of the fundamental rights I'm concerned with in the homeschooling area, it's both protection against abuse and neglect and also rights to education. Neil talked about this libertarian view and the right to sort of be free from government intervention. Again, I think when you're talking about children, you need to think about their right to positive intervention from the government to protect them. And one interesting comparison is to look at most of our peer countries, and indeed most countries in the world. Most countries in the world have built into their constitutions very positive, very powerful positive protections for child rights. Indeed, the most popular provisions that have been written into constitutions in recent decades are protections for education and protections against abuse and neglect for children. Related to that, most of our peer countries take a very different approach to homeschooling and provide much more significant regulation to ensure that children are indeed educated. So I want to focus on my two major concerns with the current unregulated state of homeschooling. And my concern with homeschooling is not homeschooling per se, it's unregulated homeschooling. It's the fact that there is virtually no meaningful regulation or oversight to ensure either protection against abuse and neglect or that children are given the fundamentals on education. So that, again, to go back to sort of just clarifying my position, I've never said that I was for a total ban, and I don't think that the, quote, presumptive ban that I do propose actually resembles anything like what Kerry described. So I'll just say briefly my concerns about both child protection and education and the kind of regulation that I think would be appropriate. As a general matter, first, I just want to emphasize that I think masses of homeschooling parents are no doubt doing a great job educating. And I have no fear that a significant number of homeschooling parents are abusing and neglecting their children. My concern is with a subset of the children who are being homeschooled. Now, mostly in our society, we regulate with respect to protecting the subset. So when you think of our regulation with respect to child abuse and neglect generally, we have regulation, we have child protective service agencies, we have mandated reporters, not because we think most parents or a majority of parents or even a huge significant number of parents abuse and neglect their children. It's because a subset do, and we need these kinds of laws and protections to protect that subset. So if we look again at homeschooling and the area of abuse and neglect, yes, I think we have reason to worry that there is a very strong connection between homeschooling and child abuse and neglect. I think there are a couple of studies, and I won't go into them now, but be happy to discuss them in the Q&A, a couple of studies that show worrisome connection. We don't have the kind of research we would like to have in this area, again, in large part because we don't have regulation, because kids aren't required to register very often, and it's hard to study this population. But there are some scary research studies out there. More generally, homeschoolers very often, and again, it's not always, but many homeschooling parents raise their children in very significant isolation. This is a fact. It is also true many homeschoolers engage their children with the outside world to a significant degree, but many do not. So isolation, the kind of isolation that characterizes lots of homeschooling parents, is a risk. If you look at the research on abuse and neglect generally, it's happens disproportionately, overwhelmingly disproportionately in isolated families. So what protects children? What did we build in as a major step when we created a child protection system in this country? We built in mandated reporters, a system of teachers and other people who come into regular contact with most children are required by law to report suspected abuse to child protective services agencies. That's how those agencies have a chance to investigate and decide if children need more, more aggressive intervention to protect them. Teachers are the largest group of mandated reporters. Most children in the society, all the children who go to public schools, have that minimum bit and very important bit of protection, that they see teachers on a daily basis or are supposed to, and teachers, if they suspect abuse and neglect, have to report it so that it can be investigated. So in that area, I think we need minimum regulation to protect children. In the homeschooling area. This is not massive surveillance of homeschooling parents, but I think before you're allowed to homeschool, there should be a check with Child Protective Services to see if the family has a significant record of abuse and neglect. And if they do have that record, I do not think the parents should be allowed to homeschool so that they can keep their children in the kind of isolation that means ongoing abuse and neglect won't be registered or reported. So the check with CPS. I also think it's important that there be contact beyond that, that homeschooling families ought to have their children see people other than the parents. So it's for that reason, or part, that's part of the reason that I propose that all homeschooling families, the children should be required to take a course, to take extra activities, to go to the public school where they will see mandated reporters and have people have other eyes on that child and the opportunity for report. A once a year visit of the kind Neil said he might be open to is not going to be enough to protect children. But, you know, we know that even when they're in schools and reported, it's often hard to get the attention of CPS. But in any event, it's obviously incredibly easy for parents to hide abuse and neglect if they only have to be seen once once a year. In the realm of education, I also think there has to be minimum regulation to protect the child's basic right to learn, to have the kind of learning that will enable that child, when child grows up, to have opportunities for employment and other opportunities in life to be part of society if they should choose to do that. So I think there has to be some check on whether the parents actually are capable of teaching. We now have almost no regulation in that respect. Only a dozen states have any requirement that parents have any credentials whatsoever in order to teach. And those states only require a high school degree. Secondly, I think there needs to be a meaningful assessment by the state, not just by parents testing their own children, but state tests to assess whether on an annual basis children are actually learning math, science, reading, writing. Skills that are going to be essential if they want to access a whole lot of employment and other opportunities. And finally, and this is my final point, time's up, I think that education needs to include some exposure to views and values other than those of the parents. This is completely different from imposing orthodoxy, which Neil registered concern with. Of course, I don't want to impose orthodoxy on children. Even if children are at school on a regular schedule, the parents have, you know, more hours of control over the child's thinking than the school does by far. I just think that it's great that parents want to raise kids in their own views and values with their own religion. I'm not trying to interfere with that. I'm saying that children have a right to exposure to some other people and ideas about how one might live one's life, so that when they become adults, they have some meaningful opportunity to choose something other than the views, the values, the culture that their own parents have chosen.
You know I am no stranger. I know rules are a bore, but just to keep you from danger, I am the law. You know I am no stranger, I know rules are a bore, but just to keep you from danger, I am the law. You know I am no stranger, I know rules are a bore, but just to keep you from danger, I am the law.
Carrie, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's great to be back, Brett. Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot has happened in our world since March when you were last on the show. Just at the beginning, I think it was within like 2 weeks of all the kids in the country being pulled out of school, So we talked about the opportunity of homeschooling. Right on cue at that time, several pieces, mostly hit pieces on homeschooling. I think the first one that I commented on my show was in Salon, but then New York Times, Washington Post. Washington Post was out when we talked last time, saying that this was going to set a generation of kids back. This was like a week and a half into kids not being in school. But, you know, the school year has ended at this point. And shortly after we talked, this Arizona Law Review paper appeared. It was written by a Harvard professor named Elizabeth Bartlett, and it was called Homeschooling: Parents' Rights Absolutism Versus Child Rights to Education and Protection. And this began a storm. Our friend Corey DeAngelis basically declared Twitter war on, well, I guess Elizabeth Bartlett isn't even on Twitter, but I know Corey was active on Twitter before that, but he really tried to engage a lot of people on this topic, defending home education and school choice. So we didn't even know that this paper existed, right? When we talked back in March, even though it was written in 2019, how did you find out about it?
Right. So what really began the firestorm, I think, this spring was the Harvard Magazine article called The Risks of Homeschooling that appeared in the May-June issue of Harvard Magazine, the alumni magazine of Harvard University, and really spotlighted Professor Elizabeth Bartlett's Arizona Law Review piece, this 80-page polemic on why we should have a presumptive ban on homeschooling, which she defines as essentially the government giving you permission potentially to homeschool your children if you meet certain conditions. So first, you'd have to deem yourself worthy in the eyes of the government to be able to homeschool your own children. You'd have to have a CPS investigation or at least a background check to make sure you haven't had any interaction in the past with CPS. You would have to agree to frequent standardized testing. She says ideally at least annually that would be administered by local school officials. You would have to commit to periodic home visits as a homeschooling family. That one really riled a lot of people, as you can imagine. And then a whole host of other requirements, including also still being required to send your kids to your local district school for at least some classes or extracurricular activities regularly. So that, as she said, so that there are these teachers and administrators and other government officials that are watching your children to make sure you're not doing them harm. This particular Harvard article and then the Arizona Law Review article that, of course, is a much lengthier discussion, really set off the homeschooling community, not only domestically, but internationally as well, with parents just completely blindsided by this and then and really angry, obviously.
We both read this piece. It seemed like she was building her argument off a problem that utilized a lot of cherry picking of examples, and I would say even caricaturing what it meant to be a homeschooler, like through some very selective exampling.
Yeah, it was really a gross mischaracterization of what 21st century homeschooling is. There was a lot of stereotyping. You know, she talked about how many families are ideologically committed to isolating their children from the mainstream culture, you know, just the sense that we're, you know, not interested in exposing our children to different beliefs and values that really is just not backed up by any compelling research. In fact, as I cited recently in our debate with Professor Bartlett Monday at the Cato Institute, I said, you know, Daniel Hamlin out of the University of Oklahoma conducted research on what he calls cultural capital and found that homeschoolers were 2 to 3 times more likely than children who attend government schools to visit the library, museums, historic sites, cultural events in a given month, and 1.5 times more likely, you know, to go to the aquarium or the zoo in a given month than, again, government school children. So, you know, this idea that somehow homeschoolers are isolated or disconnected from their community is simply not true.
Right. It was really a 20th century, you know, even still selective exampling from the 20th century, but a 20th century analysis of what homeschooling is. And the whole time that I've been involved in this world, we see the interconnectivity that people can
you know, coalesce around similar interests or activities. And I've been parts of these groups. I've been a, you know, an educational facilitator in groups like this. So we are certainly on the same page that she is mischaracterizing homeschooling, painting with a very, very broad brush, and I would say a very, very irresponsible way. But this paper gets published at the end of 2019. It is picked up first by Harvard Magazine, which we talked about. And then anybody else who is critical of or suspicious of homeschooling, that, you know, that it's just kids surrounded by Bibles and rifles or whatever people picture, they have this 80-page paper from a Harvard law professor backing them up, even if they only read the headline and the abstract, which I think is what a lot of people seem to do. How dangerous is this? Now, you went to Harvard, you have a academic background, and I'm just trying to understand. I don't want to feel like I'm overreacting to one paper written by one professor, but I think this is certainly a sign of a bigger problem, right? That these ideas come from academia, they're disseminated through the media, and eventually that does become public opinion about something. So here we are at this juncture where this term homeschooling is being Googled at a higher frequency, probably its highest frequency ever. The last time it peaked anywhere near this was the rollout of Common Core about 10, 11 years ago. So there's a lot of interest on this, and now there's this attack. And from, I would say, the perspective of most people, it looks sophisticated because it's coming from like the highest levels of academia. How dangerous is something like this from your experience?
Right. Well, I mean, of course, there's room for robust discussion and debate about all kinds of topics, particularly education, including homeschooling or private education more generally. You know, so for sure, it's appropriate for anybody to be able to, you know, share their opposing view or not be favorable toward homeschooling. I think that the issue here, though, is because it's a longtime Harvard Law School professor, because it is in a law review periodical, that it does add some teeth. It also is worth noting that there was a summit planned to coincide with the release of Professor Berthelot's Law Review article. It was scheduled for June. It was an invitation-only event that brought together academics and other activists and homeschooling opponents to talk about essentially how to more heavily regulate homeschooling. And that was postponed or rescheduled because of the pandemic. But that also, you know, showed that this isn't just one article, that there is, you know, a true opposition to homeschooling. And of course, homeschoolers are accustomed to, you know, fighting these battles. I mean, homeschooling just became legally recognized in all 50 states by the mid-1990s. So certainly the homeschooling pioneers were used to tremendous opposition. I think in some ways, those of us who are current homeschoolers have it easier thanks to those that led the way when it was so much more difficult to homeschool. But I think we have to continue to advocate and certainly fight to retain our rights to raise and educate our children as we choose. I think that the real danger is what Elizabeth Berthelot talks about toward the end of her 80-page Arizona Law Review piece, where she really is advocating for a complete reinterpretation of the U.S. Constitution. She calls the Constitution outdated and inadequate, and really suggests that we in the U.S. move from the current interpretation or the historic interpretation of the U.S. Constitution to be a focus on negative rights, meaning individuals are free from government intervention, to a positive rights interpretation, which is the government grants rights and takes a much more active role in the lives of individuals, and particularly the lives of parents and children. She talks a lot in her Arizona Law Review piece about quote-unquote peer countries, particularly these European countries that have a much more kind of positive rights view, where the government is much more involved in people's lives. And she looks at that as being something that we should aspire to here. She admits in her Arizona Law Review piece that past attempts to heighten regulation of homeschoolers at the state level have failed because homeschoolers come out
in streams to fight any kind of imposed regulation on them. And legislators back down because there's so much opposition to any increased legislation. And in fact, the trend has been over the past decade to be deregulating homeschooling throughout the country. So she acknowledges that this is an issue, which is why she says we have to come at this through the federal courts, essentially creating a presumptive ban at the federal court level. And she highlights Germany, which has long banned homeschooling. And in fact, their ban on homeschooling really goes back to 1938 and the Nazi regime, where there was this expectation that everybody fall in line and be subservient to the state.
But there is also like legal precedent for this. If homeschooling is a form of private schooling, the Supreme Court dealt with this long ago. Pierce versus Society of Sisters, right? In the height of the progressive era, this is like the mid-1920s.
Yes.
I think it was a law in Oregon that all children had to attend public school, which effectively outlaws private school or any other form of education. And the Supreme Court knocked that down. So, I mean, here we are arguably coming into, I don't know, a new progressive era, and here this issue is again. So do you know of any, like, this is a law professor, any kind of other track through the federal courts, like how that's actually going to look, how they're going to attack it to try and outlaw it, even though in the debate, she didn't seem to speak in favor of outlawing homeschooling.
Right. I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see, you know, some of your listeners might have been following the story out of Detroit, where there was a case in Detroit where graduates of the Detroit public schools sued the state because they said that they did not receive an adequate education. They had a right to an education that was not provided because of the poor conditions of their schools in Detroit. It looked like it was going to go to the Sixth District, that the entire Sixth District appellate court would vote on it. But what ended up happening is a small assembly of the Sixth Circuit voted that there was this right to the education. Then the state settled the case. And when it ultimately was sent to the whole Sixth District to rule on the case, they passed, saying, well, it's already been settled. So the good news is that because of the way that played out, there is now no legal precedent for the right to an education. And the courts have in the past upheld this idea that this is a state's issue, that, again, there's no mention of education in the U.S. Constitution. But you can already see the ways in which certain activists and lawyers are trying to move the courts in that direction towards this kind of federal acknowledgement of a right to an education, which would get to very much what Professor Barthelet is hoping for, this idea of a positive rights interpretation of the Constitution. That could be consequential, certainly for private education and especially for homeschoolers.
Okay, so let's actually get into that a little bit more by moving on to talking about this debate that happened last Monday at Cato. The argument that she basically laid out, or this perspective that she laid out, is most of we've already covered. Government needs to be a protector, right? A positive right to education and protection. Children have this positive right to protection. She does mention peer countries without actually naming them in the Cato event. She also said she's not against homeschooling. She's against unregulated homeschooling. And her primary concern is this subset, that's who the law is actually for, this small subset of children who may be abused or mistreated, and they're sort of hidden from any kind of intervention by the nature of homeschooling, that they don't have to go and check in with the state in any way. Now, her background is child advocacy. So I'm trying to see this dark world where she's probably immersed in lots of these stories and lots of these legal cases around child abuse, and sees home education not with the breadth or the depth that we see it at all, but more of as a tool abusive parents could use to conceal abuse, right? So I was trying to see it from her perspective. I was wondering if she would support something like profiling. I'm just throwing this out there. I wouldn't support profiling, but she obviously has a picture of this subset that she's so concerned about. Would she support, like, you're a homeschooling parent. You live in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You attended Harvard University. How suspicious is she of somebody like you? But certainly she has a character that she pictures that is a dangerous person. So I'm wondering if she would support something like that. What do you think?
Well, this is the real heart of the issue, right? I mean, she is concerned about, as she says, a small subset of children who could be abused by their parents under the guise of homeschooling. And so her recommendation is to impose restrictive regulation and this presumptive ban on all homeschooling families to make sure that though that subset is potentially found or saved or secured and protected. And some of the things that I brought up in not only the writing I've done about this, but certainly in Monday's debate is, first of all, there's no compelling evidence to suggest that homeschooling parents are more likely to abuse their children than non-homeschooling parents. And in fact, there's some research to suggest that homeschooling parents are actually less likely to abuse their children than non-homeschooling parents. The other thing is, you're right, this is about singling out an entire group for suspicion and surveillance because you're concerned about the actions of a few. And again, who is singling out this group for suspicion and surveillance? It's the government. And if you look at the track record of abuse of children in government schools by government educators, it's not good. You know, a 2004 U.S. Department of Education study, for example, found that 1 out of 10 students, public school students, would be sexually maltreated by a public school educator by the time the child graduates from high school. That's 5 million kids. So clearly you have heavily regulated, heavily surveilled government schools that are not doing a good job of protecting the children within their domain, in their schools. And now you want to single out a particular group to have additional government oversight. So it's really problematic. I think you bring up another very important point, that if we look about this presumptive ban and the peer countries that she talks about that have implemented either heavy regulation of homeschooling or things like these presumptive bans, it is very, very difficult to homeschool, that often the government turns families down. And I think you're right. You know, some families will be able to say, okay, we'll jump through those hoops. We'll do what you want to get permission to homeschool our kids, which, by the way, isn't really going to be independent homeschooling anymore because, you know, they have to take classes at the local district school and they have to submit to these standardized testing that a lot of parents are choosing homeschooling to avoid because they don't like the increased standardized testing and kind of compliance in government schools. So, you know, I think it would very much limit who is going to be able to homeschool. And one of the quotes that I brought up at Monday's debate and in my recent article at fee.org, where I kind of debriefed the debate, explained my key takeaways, you know, these home visits that that Professor Barthelet recommends, where homeschooling families will be singled out for periodic home visits by government agents who are mandated reporters of child abuse. Again, these are people who are, you know, their job is to look for child abuse. They're going to be coming to your house and interviewing your children to make sure you're not harming them. And you can just imagine, as I say in my fee article, that this could become a weapon of the state. And in fact, out of all of Professor Barthelet's recommendations, this recommendation about periodic home visits created the most uproar, understandably, from not only homeschoolers, but libertarians. And I received an email from a Hispanic homeschooling mom in Connecticut, who in particular was very concerned about this recommendation for home visits. And I'll just give the quote that I gave in Monday's debate that I think your listeners would appreciate. She wrote to me and said, "To state that they want to have surveillance into our homes by having government officials visit and have parents show proof of their qualified experience to be a parent to their own child is yet another way for local and federal government to do what they have done to Native Americans, Blacks, the Japanese, Hispanics, etc. in the past. Her proposal would once again interfere and hinder a certain population from progressing forward."
Yeah, and you're an ideological target too. You talked about like reports to agencies like CPS as a form of retribution by schools in some cases too, right?
Right. There was a fascinating investigative report conducted by the Hechinger Report and HuffPost back in 2018 that found that many school districts were weaponizing CPS, Child Protective Services, against non-compliant parents. So parents who may have push back on school recommendations or labels of the children or medication recommendations or just other suggestions that the school might have had, the parents saying, you know, no, I disagree. And these school districts then using CPS, calling CPS on these obstinate families. And this happens to homeschooling families as well. You say, I'm going to withdraw my kid from the school because I'm not happy with what I'm seeing there. And, you know, frequently they may get a call from CPS from the school district. So, you know, CPS is really riddled with problems. And that needs to be completely overhauled, that whole system.
Yeah, and I definitely want to come back to that before the end of the conversation, but that's actually a good way to return us to the debate that on what we've been talking about. At one point, Professor Bartlett said something like, safety for these children means being observed by more than one set of eyes. And at that point, now let's just pause there for a second. My experience, my first job in education was working at a boarding school, kids who were in state custody. You want to talk about it takes a village. At the school itself, there was an educational staff, there was a clinical staff, there was a residential staff. On the state side, there was, you know, a guardian ad litem in many cases, social workers. You're talking about 20, 25 people involved in decision-making with case management for one of these children. So there were no shortage of eyes, and none of them belonged to parents. And none of them were attached to heads with like proper incentive structures either. That was my experience there. But when she said that, safety for these children means being observed by more than one set of eyes. On the surface, that sounds true. But then I was like, oh, okay, this lady isn't running any kind of a scheme. She's a true believer. She really believes that these institutions devoted to child welfare ostensibly are without perverse incentives, without corruption. And then it presented like this kind of philosophical disconnect in the debate that never really got clarified. And I just wanted you to comment on that. I mean, obviously, the most constructive debate starts with definition of terms, clarification of philosophies. And it seemed like here in a couple of cases, mostly between Professor Bartlett and you, but also the other participant, Milton Gaither was his name. Yes. He was an education professor.
Right.
It just seemed like there was a philosophical disconnect that was never really clarified. Did you find that to be frustrating? Did you feel like everybody just got into it too fast without? Because Milton seemed like a nice guy, also, you know, with best interests of children in mind, but he kind of staked out this like I'm the historian, and I don't have a dog in this fight, and I don't have a side to play. But as it went on, actually, no, right from his opening statement, I was like, oh, yeah, you do. You have a point of view on this for sure, because you used the sort of selective examples, which they have said, people making this argument everywhere from the Arizona Law Review to stories that have heard about it on national public radio say, all we have is anecdotes. All we have is these anecdotes of abuse to terrify you with, because we can't get into these places. We can't even find out who these people are. And he took that position, I think, right from the beginning and reiterated it a few times throughout the debate. So I felt like there was this philosophical clash that was obvious, right, going into it, but was never really like clarified, and some important things were left undefined. Did you feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the reality is that both of those professors have much more faith in the state than many of us do, certainly than I do.
Right.
And that's why I tried to bring up in my examples all of the failures of the heavily regulated system of government schooling that we have that is failing children, not only in terms of protecting them from physical abuse by government educators and peers, but also abysmal academic deficiencies in these government schools. And here they are coming and saying, well, now we have to start regulating this population of families, a very diverse, heterogeneous population of families who have chosen to opt out of this government system of schooling. So I do think looking at the role of the state and faith in government, it was really the elephant in the room. You know, I mean, I think the other thing is that Professor Bartlett, you know, didn't hide the fact that she really does think that the state should be your co-parent. You know, I mean, she said in Monday's debate, she said some parents can't be trusted to not abuse and neglect their children. And then she said that is why kids are going to be way better off if both parent and the state are involved. And she said later that the state should have some say in protecting children and in trying to raise them. So I think she did put her cards on the table. I mean, she really thinks that it's important that the state be involved in raising children. And many of us, particularly libertarians, would say, you know, no, you don't have a right to raise children. Parents have a right to raise their children. There is an argument for the state having a role in protecting children from harm. And that's where we have child abuse laws in all 50 states that investigate and punish perpetrators.
One of my favorite things about the interaction, it was great because it happened like 25 times, is you use the word government schools. Yes. Instead of public schools, right? And I love that when people, because it's thought-provoking if somebody is thinking about it. But so I'm watching it and I'm listening to you do it over and over and over again and just cheering every time. And then I'm saying, wait a minute, are the people who are set up as her opponents here, is that even registering with them that public school is a euphemism and government school is a more accurate description of what we're talking about here? Are public and government just synonyms to them? So I enjoyed it. I don't know if it had any impact on either of them.
I don't know that. Look, I don't think we're going to change Professor Barthollet's mind. You know, okay. I don't think we're going to necessarily change any of these opponents who were part of that Harvard summit that was planned. You know, I think the key, I mean, I remember, you know, reading John Taylor Gatto, who always referred to public schools as government schools, him being a government school employee, you know, teacher of the year in the New York public schools. And he using the term government schools. And I think it for anyone kind of new to the discussion or thinking about the role of the state in our lives, in education, it is important to point out that they are government schools. They are government run, they are government funded, they are government controlled, and they're compulsory. You must attend under legal threat of force unless your family is able to pull you out and homeschool and or send the child to private school.
Yes, and Professor Milton did add there at the end that we can change this because we are the government. Mm-hmm. That was where I was like, okay, yeah, when we talk about this, we have to have some attention paid to philosophy. I don't know. I feel like the moderator, Neil McCluskey from Cato, laid it out and framed it as like a libertarian consideration of this issue. And I also wanted to know what you thought of his adjustment from like parental rights to parental duty.
The first thing I'd say is it's often phrased as parents have a right to make decisions for their children. And I have concerns about the idea that you have a right to make decisions for your kids. I think that nobody has a sort of inherent right to control the life of someone else. So I get concerned when we frame this as parents' rights. However, I believe that parents incur a duty to care for their children when they have kids. And that care should be aimed at enabling those kids to become self-governing when they are adults. They need to equip them to do that. What that means is providing food, housing, clothing, and yes, some level of education to equip those kids to be self-governing adults. Well, what's the role of the state? The first thing that's crucial to understand is the role of the state needs to be very heavily constrained. We have government in order to secure the rights to life, liberty, and happiness. Government exists to protect freedom, to protect us from force or fraud by others, and to maximize the sphere of voluntary association and free action. In education, that means that the default proper role of the state is to intervene only when kids have been harmed or have had harm inflicted on them. Well, what does that mean for the homeschooling discussion?
The hot potato that parental rights can be with a lot of people if it means parental ownership of children?
Well, you know, I think libertarianism is it's simpler, the philosophy of individual freedom, when you're talking about consenting adults. I think it is trickier when we talk about children.
Yeah.
And the fact is, the truth is that children are not autonomous, you know, until later in childhood and adolescence. And so they do need to be cared for. And the question is, you know, by whom? Is it their, who has the presumption of knowing what's best for children? Is it parents or is it the state? Or is it, as Professor Barthollet says, a combination of the two, this kind of co-parenting? And so I think that's really the crux of the issue. I mean, I think, again, if you look at European countries, for example, that have moved towards this positive rights perspective, this child's rights perspective, of which, you know, libertarians should be sympathetic to, right? We're focused on individual freedom for everybody, and children included. But the practical application of that that we see happen in governments around the world is that if you start to move from sort of the liberty interest of parents to raise and educate their children as they choose, which is what the courts have upheld, and certainly the Constitution, the Supreme Court has upheld in terms of interpreting the U.S. Constitution. If you move from that to a child's rights perspective, the state takes a much more interventionist role. And they will say that, hey, our government schools are the gold standard. You know, this is what's the best for children. I think that's the real problem here.
I think there's a bigger part of that too. I have this tinfoil hat. I try not to put it on when I'm talking to you because I don't want to mix you up in any of my craziness here. But that shift of focus or talking about, obviously we're sympathetic to that idea. It's been a huge part of what I've done on my show over the last 10 years. And we've talked about, you know, child development, you know, emotional health, emotional intelligence, healing from traumatic childhood. A lot of that stuff happens in families, like adverse childhood experiences, all the work that Kaiser Permanente did. Like, that's all been featured on this show in the past. But to zoom out and look at it more from like a political perspective, that is a kind of wedge into the family for the government to position itself as on the side of children. It's kind of like they're coming in your front door. If people buy into that positive rights and it's government's job to protect and enforce them argument, which is absurd if you look at what's going on in the places where they're actually managing children, like the schools or the institution that I worked in, where all of those kids, I mean, it was a private school, but all of those kids came to us and boarded with us from government custody, where they had been put in foster care, where they had been drugged, where they had been abused, where they'd been mistreated by peers or put into situations where there was a guarantee they were going to be mistreated by peers, and backs were turned on that environment. So that was actually a transformation for me philosophically, because I was very big P progressive when I did that work right out of college. That actually pushed me away from even wanting to teach in a public school. Because it's like, okay, this is the state's treatment of children. I want no part of it. And I had to come up with a whole new career path from there, largely based. I mean, I was influenced by Gatto and a handful of others around the same time, but it was the work that I was doing and the things I was seeing day in and day out in that environment, working with those kids who were in the custody of the state, that changed my mind completely. So yeah, obviously they are not good stewards from anything that I've seen, from anything that I've read or observed or had done to me as a student. But here we are. And if people are accepting that argument, I see that as an intrusion into the family, which family, community, those things are checks against the expansion of the state. That's the tinfoil hat part right there. So what are your thoughts about that?
No, I mean, I think that's right. That's why, you know, I don't know if you caught toward the end of the discussion on Monday, Professor Barthelot was talking about, again, the peer countries where there's these home visits that young children get, you know, in some cases part of the National Health Service, where you have a baby and then you get these visitors to come in and help you. And of course, it really depends on the biases of those individuals, right? You know, what do they think of your parenting? What do they think of your values? She made the point to state in commenting about or praising these home visits in these European countries, she made the point of saying that they're voluntary. Of course, the recommendation that she has with a presumptive ban on homeschooling, these home visits are not voluntary. They are required. If you were to be granted permission to homeschool your kids, you have to agree to this first. But I also think, you know, even in the case of these supposed voluntary home visits, you know, you have to wonder how that plays out, right? So again, if you are somebody who, you know, maybe lives acceptably and you say, oh, you know, I don't need the nurse to come in, we're fine. And you sort of fit a profile of privilege, for example, no one's going to say anything to you, right? But if you happen to be maybe low income, a minority, or someone that, you know, has a different kind of ideology that's separate from the state, you know, for example, Professor Barthelot spent a lot of time in her law review article slamming conservative Christians. You know, I just worry that if you were to opt out and you don't fit kind of the state profile of the acceptable parent, what is that going to mean for you? So this is, again, the problem of shifting power from individuals to the state.
Right. Have you ever tried to unpack that with somebody who's so on the other side of the argument? I mean, the most obvious thing that comes to mind that's been really useful in the last 4 years with me is like, okay, so you create all this, you create this apparatus. How would you like Betsy DeVos to be in charge of it? How would you like her to be presiding over it? I would think that would be at least something to pause and think about. But I mean, like, I know you've been at this longer than just the, you know, the span of the Trump administration. So have you tried to like articulate more of our libertarian point of view on this with these people? And have you ever gotten anywhere? Because I know it was hard to do in this 90-minute format like this. And that was part of my frustration watching it, even though I really enjoyed it. And I thought a lot of good information was presented, obviously, and it was an important thing to happen. But it's a hard gap to bridge in 90 minutes.
Right. I mean, I think this was, you know, certainly the highest profile, you know, showcase of kind of what I believe are libertarian values against, you know, more of the statist ideology as it applies in this case to homeschooling. But I think, you know, the whole point or the advantage of the libertarian worldview is that it says, you know, humans are flawed. And so the more that we can disperse power and decentralize power to put it in the hands of individuals instead of the state, the better off we'll be.
Also, regarding the debate, they said at one point that like 120 questions had poured in. Thousands of people had watched this.
Yeah.
Was there anything that you were hoping to be asked that you were not asked?
We talked about a lot of the issues that I was hoping that we would get to. You know, it's kind of these key issues around how do you protect a subset of children? You know, do you make laws to protect that subset that negatively impact the larger population? You know, we got into, again, separating the idea of homeschooling and child abuse. I mean, I think that in particular in the Law Review article, Professor Barthollet was very concerned about these outlier examples of children who had been abused by their parents under the guise of homeschooling. And I brought up the point in the debate that a large percentage of the very tiny number of children who are abused under the homeschooling cover were already known to CPS. So again, to me, it wasn't an issue of more heavily regulating homeschooling. It was an issue of overhauling the current system that we have that is meant to protect children.
So, and again, from Professor Barthollet's, like, in her defense, I would say, like, doing legal work around child advocacy and child protection, she has probably been immersed to some degree in things that are, while maybe statistically insignificant, quite emotionally impactful. I can certainly sympathize with that. And that obviously creates a perspective. And I think that started to come through. I read the Arizona Law Review paper angrily, right? Like that was my, that was my lens that I was using for that. So I tried, but I didn't do a great job of like seeing it from her point of view. I saw how it was going to be used by people who were enemies of homeschooling for other reasons, but I felt like she had a very shallow knowledge of the actual practice and how it's changed in the 21st century and a depth of experience with what can go wrong in her mind when people are not being properly watched.
Right.
So I actually felt like she made several concessions that I wasn't expecting her to make in the debate.
You did? Okay. What did you think?
Here's the thing. There was nothing behind it, right? It's like she said something like, and I made a meme. I didn't post it because I thought it was kind of snotty. But at like 40 minutes into it, she goes, public school has a lot of problems. So I took a picture of her and put that up as a quote. And I was going to post it in the School Sucks group. But I told you about it. That's and everybody else about it. So maybe that's just as satisfying. She said that. She said some schools are worse than others. She said she's not against homeschooling. So there were lots of revelations that I was not expecting. But not much behind them as far as like anything else she was suggesting, which is what we've been talking about here. So was there anything that you wanted her to be asked that she was not asked?
Well, it gets kind of your earlier question. I mean, one thing that I think would have been interesting if there was an opportunity for it to come out, Corey DeAngelis, who we mentioned before, has been very much on top of this, calling out a lot of the hypocrisy of this. He uncovered a 2014 television interview between Professor Barthollet and a journalist at Russia Today. And he has links to this in a lot of his work. In fact, a recent article at the Daily Caller where he includes this quote. So much of Professor Barthollet's career has been focused on expanding adoption rights. And she's done some just really incredibly positive work in the adoption space, particularly international adoption. And this was a really antagonistic back and forth between a journalist who had, you know, a lot of concerns about international adoption and Professor Barthollet trying to, you know, be a proponent for it. And one of the key pieces that came out in this 2014 interview was the columnist was saying, you know, oh, there are these examples of children who have been adopted from foreign countries by American parents and are being abused. And then this is her response. Again, kudos to Corey for uncovering this. She said, quote, "People who do not like international adoption love the fact that occasionally scandals show up because those scandals can be used as a way to shut down international adoption." Hmm. Which, of course, is really essentially the argument that she's putting down here with homeschooling, right? Is that, yes, occasionally there will be outliers. Occasionally there may be these, you know, horrendous stories. And we, of course, our heart would go out to anyone impacted by abuse or neglect. But we shouldn't use these scandals to be a reason to shut down something that is very positive for the vast majority, the overwhelming majority of parents and children.
Did you feel like it was impolite to bring that up during the conversation?
I was waiting for the right moment. I just don't think we had an opening for it.
No, it's true. I mean, it's definitely the fallacy of selective attention. And that was why I made that meme of, it's like, okay, well, if academia says selective attention is okay, then here's this woman speaking out against public schooling. But yeah, and I think it's like, at this point, we just have to tolerate the rest of the media doing that kind of cherry picking and selective exampling. But yeah, we would want something better from somebody who's trying to make a, you know, a legal case against homeschooling that has, through, you know, the leverage of media, the possibility of being very persuasive at a time where this issue is very, very important. Final question I had for you. You do feel like the home education community will win this in the end?
I do. Again, what I wrote in my most recent fee.org article Friday was, you know, there are very few movements today that bring together such a diverse group of people as homeschooling does. I mean, homeschoolers, you know, don't fit neatly into any box and very often don't agree on much of anything except for preserving the freedom to raise and educate their children as they choose. That's really what brings them together. And I think that strength shows that, you know, this really cuts across the political spectrum, cuts across geographics, demographics, different ideologies, to bring together a really diverse group of people focused on preserving individual freedom. And I think that that's a really strong point, not only for the future of homeschooling and hopefully, you know, continuing the process of deregulating homeschooling in states, because there are still many states that are more difficult to homeschool in than others, but also just, you know, as in divisive times, seeing how diverse people can come together in favor of liberty.
Yeah. And it is, I guess it is helpful for an outsider to come along once in a while and start snooping around for all these people to go, oh, wait, we are kind of a tribe here. Maybe we could get together to defend ourselves from something like this. Yeah. So I think the timing of it is great. You know, like you said, there's a lot of energy toward not only just the expression of the benefits and the opportunities of home education, but there's also a lot of energy around the defense of it right now, too. So I think these are all positive developments. Because all of this came out of a child welfare, this is actually one final question. Because all of this debate came out of a child welfare concern, mm-hmm. right, that she, Professor Barthollet, expressed in this law review paper last year, from a more libertarian perspective, while we could certainly criticize CPS, which you mentioned, and we've mentioned many times on the past and in the show, is a very corrupt institution. A former regular contributor to the show named Carlos Morales wrote a book
illegally kidnapped, the case against CPS, and he had actually worked for CPS in Texas as a young man, I think right out of college. And he had horror stories. He told them on the show. So we saw perverse incentives and lots of institutional corruption there. And the way it can be also weaponized.
Right.
It's like there's so many things in government where, say you work for the Border Patrol, you could be in a high-speed chase with gunfire against coyotes and you're doing your job. But you could also be searching the trunk of some family, you know, at a checkpoint and you're doing your job. What I mean is that I feel like a lot of these types of so-called services gravitate to easier work. CPS, and this was from talking to people who worked for CPS, there's lots of ways to do your job. And institutionally, you have to keep justifying the existence of the institution,
right,
like with any government department or operation. So CPS has, if it, like perverse incentives, it has an incentive to continue existing and growing, right, meaning it has to find more and more cases to open. So there's lots of problems with the way CPS works right now. Obviously, the weaponization that you talked about is amongst the biggest. But as far as alternatives to this, you want to see how far I can kick a can down the road? I would say that Nathaniel Brandon, who wrote The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem, had this idea of the inheritance, right? Where if there's family dysfunction at one generation, it's going to be passed to the next and to the next and to the next. And it meant a sort of philosophical revolution in ideas about raising children and the treatment of children that would have to take place over a long period of time for there to be less a need for these kinds of interventions. That's a centuries-long project, right? The other part of that would be we've seen the disappearance of community,
yeah,
in a lot of ways in our society, because most people are going to some sort of surrogate connection through screens. People don't know their neighbors anymore. So things that used to fall on communities, like child welfare was a mutual interest in the town I grew up, in the community that I grew up. It's certainly true in lots of neighborhoods, even in more urban areas. And I think we've seen a disintegration of that in the last half century as more and more of these responsibilities have been outsourced to schools or juvenile justice or organizations like CPS. And maybe there's like, you know, changes to cities and the ways people live that also, I mean, it's a very multifaceted problem. But another thing that's disappeared during that time is mutual aid societies. The idea that people have, a common interest that they can self-organize around solving some kind of problem. You know, like we still see this today where there's sort of these Obamacare exemptions for health insurance where you can join like a medical mutual aid society. Have you heard of those?
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But there was a book called The Tragedy of American Compassion about how welfare state mechanisms basically crowded out all of these things that used to exist as far as mutual aid. But I really think that child welfare is obviously it's a family responsibility, but if it fails at that level, it becomes a community responsibility first.
Right. I mean, I think that's absolutely true. Everything that you said, the more that we can rely less on government to secure our rights, the better, right? So, you see government schools still having many instances of abuse by educators and peers. And then you also see that this could happen in homes as well, including occasionally in homeschooling homes. But now you're empowering another government agency to protect those children. And I think that there's just always going to be failures in that system. And just the reality that we're just unfortunately not going to be able to protect every individual, right? That this is just sort of the nature. We don't live in this utopia. There's this idea of the nirvana fallacy, right? That we're just always looking for perfection, and it stops us from sort of moving ahead. So I think the more that we can rely less on government, the better. And I think these mutual aid societies provide a really great example of what that might look like, of, you know, community building and gathering with others and seeing how that might work in this case. Because I think, as I've said before, CPS is riddled with problems. I think another key point that's specific to CPS is that they sort of operate outside, in many cases, of the judicial system. So in many cases, parents are not charged with any crime. There's investigations, there's plans put in place, but there were never any crimes. There were never any charges against the parents.
So there's no real appeal.
So there's no real appeal. And even Professor Barthelet said, oh, it's very difficult to get convictions of child abuse. And I think that's a problem. You know, if we are going into people's lives and interjecting into our, you know, the government into people's homes, you know, how can we do that with, you know, without violating due process? And right now there seems to me to be quite a few violations of due process in the system. For example, there's a great book by Diane Redleaf, who's a longtime family attorney and activist. She wrote the book, They Took the Kids Last Night. And she cited data that in 2016 alone, 7.5 million families, or the CPS received 7.5 million calls of suspected child abuse or neglect. They ended up investigating about 4 million, a little over 4 million of those calls. And then 676,000 children were labeled as having been abused or neglected. And there was, of course, a wide range of severity in that number, from, you know, you left your kid in the yard unattended to severe abuse. But, you know, that means that, you know, that you have 7 million families that are being called on for, you know, what is a small percent, less than 10%, that are even being labeled as some kind of abuse or neglect, some kind of substantiated claim. So millions of families are being interrogated by a government agency and not charged with, in many cases, in most cases, not being charged with any crime. I just think that, you know, if we're going to talk about reforming CPS, maybe we start there.
What does that look like to you just on the surface, that reform?
You know, get a warrant, for one thing, to come into a family's home, and then, you know, do an investigation. And if there's substantiated claims, then you arrest the parents. But I think so often, you know, these families are disrupted. And again, there's no charges that are ever brought forth.
Yeah. And it's just kind of looming in places where maybe it shouldn't be, while missing things that it should catch.
That's right. That's right. And that's where, you know, again, one of the troubling recommendations back to the Arizona Law Review piece and Professor Barthelet's recommendations is that homeschooling families, you know, need to have these background checks. And if there was ever any interaction with CPS, that would be a red flag. And in many cases would mean that you wouldn't get permission to homeschool your children. But again, going back to what I said earlier, is that a lot of families choose homeschooling because they are dissatisfied with what's happening in the schools. They don't agree with whatever recommendations or approaches the school is doing. And often it's the school then weaponizing CPS against these parents. So I would very much worry if now we're preventing parents from homeschooling when the reason they chose homeschooling is because they disagreed adamantly with what they were seeing in the government school.
Right. It could be akin to like the terrorist watch list that you find out you're on when you try to get on. I'm not saying you're on. I'm not saying I'm on it, but it certainly crosses my mind every time I'm at an airport, where hundreds of thousands of people could have had run-ins with CPS for no good reason. But then based on that criteria, Professor Barthelet wants, they don't have educational freedom anymore because of that.
Right. And I've seen, you know, it's been interesting to see some of the discussions come out of Monday's debate. Of, you know, there are homeschoolers and others who are in favor of more regulation of homeschoolers and homeschooling. And I've seen, you know, some recommendations, like one said, well, all homeschooling families should just be known to CPS. And I just find that terrifying, that it's the same idea of like a Muslim registry, which we hopefully all find to be abhorrent. You know, it's the same idea that, well, all homeschooling families need to be on some kind of registry and some watch list by government agents.
So what's next for you? Is this over, or is there going to be more? Does this still have momentum?
Well, we'll see. You know, I'm speaking at Porkfest later this week. Corey DeAngelis and I will be at Porkfest in New Hampshire. This will be a key topic of discussion there. I'll be at Freedom Fest in Las Vegas next month. And again, I think this conversation will continue. You know, I mean, I think, as I said earlier, homeschoolers have long fought for their freedom to raise and educate their children. I think it's now time for current homeschoolers, those of us who have come to homeschooling really only in the past decade, who've had the easy path so far because of all the hard work of the pioneers. I think it's time for us to step up and make sure that we're continuing to fight for liberty.
Well said. Thank you so much for sharing all of this. And thanks for coming back to give us a review of this much anticipated event that took place. By the time my audience hears this show, it will be 1 week ago today at Cato. It was great to hear your thoughts. I'm going to see you at Porkfest, I think. What days are you going to be there?
Great. Yeah. Corey and I are presenting on Saturday, so I'll be up later in the week.
Awesome. I will see you there. Thank you so much, Carrie.
Thanks, Brett.